Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, how familiar with you are you with your stigmas? Do you live in a stigmatic life? Are you subject to a stigmatic life? Because we all have opinions. And what opinions create? Stigmas. So maybe we just can't get away from it. But to help us understand it deeper and to understand why we misunderstand things and live in a society that seems to be denser and denser, we want to cut to the quick and awaken ourselves to maybe a greater logical understanding of life. And to do that, I want to introduce the author of an amazing book called Sane Asylums. And maybe that's what we should desire more than living in a world that feels like an insane asylum. And now let's sane up with the author of Sane Asylums, The Success of Homeopathy Before Psychiatry Lost Its Mind. Well, what does that mean? That's important. So I want to introduce our guest, this wonderful author, Dr. Jerry Cantor. Jerry, welcome to Energy Stew.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure to be here. And by the way, I'm not officially a doctor. I'm a homeopath practicing under my acupuncture license. But I have studied a fair amount of medicine.
Okay. Well, I'm very impressed with you. So, to me, you're a doctor. This is so important. What I was saying about what are stigmas and why, what is insane versus sane? Maybe insane is a stigma. And your book is really addressing that directly with the title.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of stigma, I'd like to say, you know, we have a couple of very major denials going on in society today. We have a climate change denial. We have Holocaust denial. I'm the child of Holocaust survivors, in fact. But I would venture to say that denial of homeopathy's tremendous power ranks up there. I don't want to consider myself a conspiracy theorist, but the rabbit hole I fell down into studying this, it really revealed to me what an unbelievable shame it is and what a tragedy it is that people's awareness of homeopathy has been so distorted. And you can argue with the science, you can argue with the ideology, but for God's sakes, how can you argue with the history of this? Mental hospitals existed. They were a huge part of culture. Homeopathy was not a sect, it was not a heresy, very mainstream. And the homeopathic mental hospitals were so superior to the other ones. It's astounding to me what was buried there. And as you say, has become a stigma. Back to mental illness, people talk about mental illness being a stigma. I think it's a stigma because of mental illness is really a problem with life. It's not that people have a disease that they should be ashamed of. The stigma is that it has been mischaracterized as a disease, and it's really a problem of life. I piggyback on the work of Thomas Szasz quite a bit, who was a psychiatrist who wrote many, many books on this topic, and he had enormous credibility. The school that he taught at, the medical schools, is profiting from his books, but they have gone completely wholesale into biological medicine and basically teach nothing that he actually taught. Your other question of what is mental illness was a huge problem for me until I kind of resolved it to my satisfaction in writing this book. I don't know if you got to the end of it, but I have an appendix, which I call the Compendium of Mental Illness Perspectives. And as a brain dump for myself on every way in which you can look at every kind of what's been considered mental illness, from the positive side, negative side, I'm really quite proud of that section.
And I enjoyed reading them.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Thank you so much. I felt I had to do that, put it all in one place, because otherwise I'd be all throughout the book trying to create context for these homeopathic ideas and situations. So that was really a rabbit hole I fell down also, but it was enjoyable to do.
Well, what's amazing is that I think we misunderstand disease. And I've been involved for a long time understanding that most physical ailments are psychosomatic.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? That means that they don't exist by themselves. They exist because of circumstances.
You know, in Chinese medicine, I'm an acupuncturist too. The mind-body connections are absolutely hardwired into the theory. If you see an acupuncturist and you say you've got loose stools, the acupuncturist will automatically know that you worry too much. And conversely, if you're a worrier, he's going to ask if you have loose stools. If you've had a long grief that you're suffering, he or she will ask all kinds of questions relating to your lungs, and the other way around too.
Right.
So Chinese medicine is based on the idea of harmonizing the energy. Homeopathy is based on the idea, at least as I practice it, of actually revolutionizing the energy. So we don't want to harmonize things so much as explode delusions that lead to illness through that mind-body connection.
Right, but the delusion has to do with improper information. And what I feel is happening in life is that information is distorted. And homeopathic remedies are information.
That's
acupuncture,
right.
Actually, is every way that we awaken ourselves to greater information, including flow, like, for instance, the flow of meridians, that informs the body of how to behave properly, the meridians. So in acupuncture, you are adjusting the meridians so they flow properly, so the body then is awakened to know what to do.
Here's another way of looking at it. Again, advanced placement common sense. Acupuncture is a mini stabbing. Stabbing.
Yeah.
And homeopathy is a mini poisoning. And so what we're doing here, in both instances, in both instances, we're exploiting the body's reactivity. You know, when I was in junior high school, I had a teacher said made an impression on me that one of the definitions of life is irritability. You poke it and it responds. I thought that was pretty funny when I was in junior high school, but now many years later, I feel this is absolutely true. You poke an object and it responds. Now, how it responds and how you poke it, that's homeopathy. You know, that's the extremely specific kind of a thing. But that is energy. That is information, as you put it. That kind of poking or that little mini poisoning is this gentle prompt, another way of saying it is kind of a permission slip to the body. Hey, look at this. Here's something that you haven't looked at for a long time that's causing a problem, right?
Right.
And the body says, whoa, I don't want to do that. I don't like that. But wait a minute. That's not as harsh as I've encountered it before. All right, let me get to deal with that. So the vital force kind of rolls up its sleeves and says, yeah, okay, I'll process that.
Right.
And you get to the other side of it.
You're poking it with a new truth.
That's absolutely true. But in a manageable form, a homeopathic remedy is a revisitation of trauma under more favorable circumstances.
That's true. It's just the way that we use life to learn from life. And it's amazing. I love homeopathy, and I go back many decades being familiar with it, and have a whole lot of remedies sitting around the house that I like to draw from their information at times when I need it. It's amazing how many remedies there are. And so I work with people who I think need homeopathy, and they go, oh, I've been to a homeopath, it didn't help. Well, it's hard to get the right remedies. You know, it takes a really wise homeopath to know how to find the right remedies. It takes patience, a lot of questioning, a lot of awareness, and familiarity with so many different remedies that you can find your way.
With skill, with experience, you develop an algorithm which makes you quicker. I mean, when you're starting out as a homeopath, you think, oh my God, how am I going to get anybody to come to me? When you get good enough, you say, oh my God, how am I going to get these people out of my office?
Oh, good. I love that.
And so you have to cut to the chase. So that's one thing I know that I've intuitively done. I've figured out an algorithm that gets me to the right remedy, but even when there are, well, initially there's going to be, you know, 1,000 or something I've got to choose from. How do I narrow that down? With experience that comes, yeah. And looking at some, everything is information, how somebody looks, their expressions, their gestures, how they walk in the door. You very, very quickly have to narrow your questioning. But you get there. And it shouldn't be that much trial and error. Accuracy is at a premium with this kind of work.
But what you're saying is so important in terms of how they walk in the door. It's everything. In other words, a homeopath has to be aware of every idiosyncrasy of a person's life in order to fit all the pieces together.
That's right.
So it takes very wise people to be homeopaths.
good tools that you then internalize. I mean, I have lots and lots of books. I don't necessarily go through them each time. I don't when someone comes in. But if I, every day, there are going to be circumstances where I have to go and look at some old book.
Uh-huh. Wow.
You know, so the tools matter, but you internalize their lessons. And the books also have contradictory information. So you have to figure out your own understanding of a remedy. And
right.
Make them work. And right. The other really weird thing is you make friends with the remedies. We have what's called a morphic field. My remedies work for me. They might not work for someone else, but absolutely something happens. Something special happens between the practitioner and his or her remedy cabinet. Wow. And the remedies become friends. And I know this because one day I'll use some remedy I just haven't used for decades or maybe never used. And God damn it, I'll have to use it again 3 or 4 times the next week. I thought I'd lost my mind when this started happening. Now I'm quite accustomed to it. It's called what Jung called a synchronicity. The universe knows that you have this remedy and you understand it and starts sending people to you who need it.
I love this. This is so profound. Now, what I want to look at with you is why we don't need insane asylums anymore and what is a sane asylum. Because sure. The hospitals of the past, the homeopathic hospitals, were not just like medical hospitals today. They were hospitals that had wise people treating their patients as wholesome beings to begin with and bringing them back to wholeness. And they did it compassionately and wisely.
Yeah.
And you talk about in the book, you talk about the ideal nurse. So what, you know, how do we have to treat people is that people are, that there is a greatness inside everybody if they're treated properly and understood properly and given the opportunity to be whole.
Well, that's, I'm not going to be able to answer that in very quickly. That's the book length topic, which is why I wrote this.
Right.
Everything was bad. This time, the time frames I'm dealing with is basically 1875 to 1925. Madness was completely different then. You didn't have iatrogenic conditions. You didn't have things like tardive dyskinesia, schizophrenia. Well, I mean, so many things we're suffering from today are actually caused by the drugs that we use. This is before the Flexner Report, when everybody was using the same medicines and there wasn't a profit motive attached to these things. Homeopaths and allopaths use the same medicines, just to different potencies. But these what I call sane asylums were they had things in common with the other hospitals too that practiced moral care, which was just respect for the mentally ill, giving them opportunities. But they also had a terrible problem when people were violent and uncontrollable, and they used these horrific restraints and, you know, all kinds of barbaric therapies. Whereas the homeopathic hospitals had the recourse of these amazing remedies on top of that.
But that's the point, is that it's resolvable with the right, let's call the remedies information. When you give the body the information it needs to know itself better so it can change its behavior, is what the point is. You know, the objective is to reinform the person through remedies to know better.
But the other big thing, Peter, was that Also, time was so different. First of all, almost all medicine was practiced in the home. People had, you know, families. There was a lot of support within the family. You didn't go to a hospital automatically. It was very different. The asylums, though, they did not kick you back into the community right away. There's a reason they're called asylums. People could stay there for a long, long time, and there was no rush to send them back. After the Civil War, the country was really, in large measure, completely insane. From the grief and the carnage of that experience, I learned all kinds of amazing stuff to writing this. That at that time, people believed in the resurrection of the body. That when you died, your body would literally be resurrected. They had a tremendous respect for the last words of somebody. That someone as they're dying was more important than that. The fact that they died was that they had something spiritual to say about their life. Well. The Civil War, bodies were blasted to pieces everywhere. They couldn't be identified. People suffered so much they did not have wise words to give, and the country went crazy. These mental hospitals proliferated. They're everywhere. So a lot of healing had to take place. Homeopathy happened to be at its zenith in around 1875. Lincoln's cabinet was full of homeopaths. It was very well known, very powerful thing, and so. People like Selden Talcott, the superintendent of the Middletown Hospital that I dedicated this book to, was, as you say, like a very, very wise person. He was a Civil War doctor, but a powerful homeopath. And he had this vision of what a mental hospital should be like. And they were tremendously popular. And people had an opportunity through every means, through agriculture, playing instruments, from having fantastic nurses like Clara Barris tend to them. It was not about suppression of their problem, but helping them through moral hygiene, you know, deal with their life problems, dealing with their issues, and have enough time to work these things through in a beautiful place.
And you talk about playing baseball too.
the Telden Talcott did this amazing thing. I had so much fun writing the baseball chapter. The team he developed there called the Asylums were not just an innovation; they were a terrific team. They played major league teams. They had winning records against everybody. And the mental patients loved it. And today we all know that baseball is wonderful for mental health. Is something about it that's very, very special. And I wrote a whole chapter about that too. But that goes back to Selden Talcott, who perceived this initially.
I think it's always been a very slow sport. But I think in the way it's structured, it helps people feel aligned.
Yeah, and I go into that. It's very everyday. A lot of times, not much is going on. The player is standing around, scratching, itching, blowing his nose. And all of a sudden, you know, like in life, I mean, most of life is work a day. But every once in a while, you've got to do something special, which can have a tremendous impact. So many idiosyncrasies are tolerated in baseball. It's just a marvelous parallel to life, and very, very absorbing, because it's so relatable, and there's so much wackiness in it. Yeah, it's terrific. And Selden Talcott, he picked up on this very, very astutely.
Yeah, it's fascinating how we're drawn to different sports and for different psycho-emotional reasons. And there must be interesting remedies that have to do with the relationships of that. And so there's so much, and you also talk about, there's so many aspects of the book that have real great insight to them. There's something about nanomedicine and Nasrin, NASRN, which there's such wisdom about understanding how to tackle what we know as disease through understanding chemistry better in a way that aligns with our own chemistry.
Well, this is a long-standing question. It's always been believed and thought and hoped that there'd be a very strong correlation between the body's chemistry and mental illness. That has been almost impossible to find, Peter, frankly. It's almost impossible. Everybody pays lip service to it. The homeopaths did too, but in the end, they did not monkey with a body's chemistry from a biological perspective. They still, even though they talked that talk, saying, yeah, it's a disease, they still returned to the idea of using the totality of symptoms to prescribe homeopathically. So they didn't go down that rabbit hole that psychiatric medicine did and went crazy with, literally, but when they found they could make so much money from patenting the byproducts of the petro industry.
Right, but if we understand the body, diseases in the body as misinformation. So if we can tackle the misinformation, which comes from our sense of reality that we're dealing with, you know, our struggles and our, and in total biology, they call it micropsychoses. We all have different micropsychoses, little gaps in our information in our mind that we can't deal with. And that then reflects itself in our bodies through disease.
But if you attack the body from that biological perspective, you're not doing it any favor. You have to do it from the informational level, as you say, you know, first. Then the chemistry will change. If you do it from underneath up, it's not going to work.
Exactly.
You're suppressing symptoms, and you're not dealing with the problem from its origin.
Right. So the misinformation starts at the top,
yeah,
and trickles down to the body. And then the body is trying to figure itself out with misinformation. And that's why it's uneasy, called disease.
I was really impressed with the work of Clara Barris, this fantastic nurse who I contrast with Clara Barton, who was another Clara Barr, both tremendously important people. She wrote this incredible book called Nursing the Insane in 1908, which I think is the greatest nursing book ever written. And you see the commitment. She worked at the Middletown Hospital for 14 years as a homeopathic physician. And this idea of moral hygiene, grappling with people's life, you know, really trying very, very hard, going to, you know, battling with their demons, for, you know, energetically and in terms of discussion and being kind to them and respectful, and is something that absolutely doesn't happen anymore, because we're just medicating everybody in these horrible, horrible psychiatric clinics. Anyway, it's really something to see what she did. And so I like to give her due. Clara Barris became well known as the muse of a naturalist called John Burroughs. And he was a friend of John Muir. And this whole chapter of her life, where she was this fantastic homeopathic physician at the mental hospital in Middletown, you know, something I want to give her due.
Great. No, you give a lot of due in the book to the founders in this homeopathic world, in this country. And it's so important. I hope our audience really wants to look more at what homeopathy is and what it can do for the future, because you do have, at the end of the book, you talk about an ideal future. And it's wonderful to see, because it's a utopia that we all aspire to. And maybe this whole world is crazy because it really is misinformed in so many ways, and is struggling to latch on to any information it can that often isn't the right information anyway. So we're stuck.
There's one thing I want to say, Peter, because people always think that the way things are, the way it naturally develops. So people have this idea, and it's been consciously perpetuated and also subconsciously, that homeopathy is old-fashioned. It's just some old crazy thing that got pushed aside because so much more modern, more clever stuff came along. The reason I wrote Sane Asylums was to show, and I've got a big chapter on that called Concessions to the Spirit of the Times, how this happened, that something so powerful, so fantastic, got sidelined. And the history of that is very, very important. People have to revisit that, because if you don't understand history, it will repeat itself. And I do need to get people over this idea that, well, it's old-fashioned, it's hodgepodge, it's passé, when exactly the opposite is true. It's probably something we need more than anything else. And denial that homeopathy is not only cogent but powerful, maybe, you know, probably more powerful than conventional medicine in so many ways, I swear, I think it's akin to Holocaust denial and climate change denial. It's an amazing tragedy, because we would look at things so, so differently.
Right.
Anyway,
that's why your book is so important, because it really helps us understand the history of homeopathy and how effective it was in ways that now there don't seem to be answers for.
And we have powerful answers. It's just that we're under the radar. The campaign against homeopathy by the pharmaceutical industry and the American Medical Association has been longstanding, very, very powerful, and very, very well funded. But these things that go, you know, powerful and true, they don't go away. When I was an acupuncturist, my generation created the acupuncture profession. When I came out in the 1970s practicing, it was not licensed anywhere. We had to practice needling secretly. We were called voodoo doctors, all kinds of bad things. And then 40, 50 years later, it's licensed in every single state. And people come out of Ivy League schools and become acupuncturists. Isn't that amazing? And there was no, what made that change? It was nothing from the scientific establishment. There was nothing from research that did that. It was simply people recognizing that acupuncture worked, and it was a great thing to do. It's still not recognized in terms of insurance. That battle is still going on. But homeopathy will never go away either. And as a matter of fact, 300 million people around the world use it. They may not understand why, but it will never go away, because the principle of using like to cure like is a law of nature. And that's not going to go away, no matter how you try to make people disbelieve it.
Well, truth prevails.
Truth prevails. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
It sticks around, and in terms of popularity, you know, it ebbs and flows. But as you say, truth prevails.
Right, and that's why I'm so glad to be talking with you, and why your book is really so important for people to read, and understand, you know, the depth of the homeopathic world and how important it is for the future, because it's really how we're going to make people better and get rid of the stigmas that are all around us. And it's, you know, it's hard to live in a world where there's just, you know, it's all about opinions that are misinformed.
Yeah. And the misinformation comes at many, many levels.
Yes.
I'm every day I'm encountering super intelligent people who have just such false ideas about things. It takes a lot to create an awareness that's different from that. We live so much by fear now. Everything fear. All our diseases are rooted in you call it misinformation. In homeopathy lingo, we call it a delusion, which is a harsh kind of a term. But the remedies, when they're properly chosen, create an opportunity for the subconscious to overcome that delusion. They're like a little bomb placed deep in the subconscious. And then after 4 or 5 weeks of processing, and things can get worse before they get better, people come back with a very different perspective of things. And lo and behold, their illnesses also disappear.
It's amazing. And this book, and you also list so many psychological conditions that are misunderstood, and how there are remedies for them. So I love talking with you. We're at the end of the show, and it's like there's so much to say. But your book is called Sane Asylums. How can people follow up?
I'm very fortunate that I've gotten a mainstream publisher, so it's available through Simon & Schuster. You can get it at Amazon.com. It's published by Inner Traditions. It's also in Kindle. I think people should just read it and start discussing it and sharing it with people. I really do hope that it makes an impression and it has a breakthrough. And the kibosh on homeopathy is extended to the fact that even the mainstream medical houses like Team and Elsevier and Springer have recently stopped publishing homeopathic medical books. That's how strong the kibosh was. And so I'm very, very privileged that I was able to get this book through.
Yeah.
And the argument I made was it addresses the reason why that has happened. So I'm trying to reverse that trend, and I hope it
The book does a good job. Thank you so much. Thanks for being the guest on Energy Stew. I'm so happy to talk with you.
Peter, thank you very, very much for having me here. It was a wonderful discussion.
Thank you.
And I appreciate your understanding of this.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.live. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you. And thanks so much for listening.